is Dr. Katie Hay, Associate Professor of Physics from PLU in Tacoma, Washington. In her talk this afternoon, her discussion is "Our Place in the Cosmos, Space and Time Are Not What They Appear to Be." Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming to the talk today. And it will be more of an interactive talk as well. Is everyone able to hear me all right? Okay. Oh, a little bit. Let's see. I will attempt to figure that out. Okay. I have always been interested in the stars and astronomy, and that's kind of what got me into science in the first place. And today, I just want to share with you some of my favorite parts. So that's what this is, a fusion of the best stuff of cosmology. Cosmology is closely related to astronomy, so I just wanted to point out there's a few things going on this week. 16th through 18th, which is right now. you should be able to see, this is going to be pretty late, like 10 or 11 p.m., so I know that's pretty late here. But Saturn and Mars will be close, and I've also noticed in the last few evenings that you can see Jupiter over the second, the highest peak on that side of our view. And just to introduce you to myself, I went to Oregon State University for my PhD, and that's what that is. I studied physics, fluid dynamics mostly, with always an interest in astronomy. And I think my interest in astronomy came from growing up in national park systems, where my father was a park ranger in Death Valley, Yellowstone, Crater Lake. I didn't know I was lucky as a kid to be able to see the Milky Way every night, but that was my that was my experience. So you can't help but fall in love with the stars in a place like that, as you know. In graduate school, for a short time, I got to work my dream job at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, NASA's facility in California. And I worked on the Dawn spacecraft and helped write the timeline for this this spacecraft as it got close to asteroid Vesta to search for moons in a mosaic for moon images and take data on Vesta. And now that Dawn is orbiting around Ceres. But I, when it came time to find a job, I decided not to stay at JPL, sadly, because you cannot see the stars. It's like an injustice. The people who work at NASA in Los Angeles have smog view. You cannot see the Milky Way or anything. And I include that picture because this is the Goldstone Observatory, and this is me and my friends, and that is a bus. Look how big that is compared to the bus. It's about the same distance away from us. That's like, they're these huge, it looks like a huge garden of these bizarre flowers in the desert, just way out in the middle of nowhere where you're listening for radio signals. This is some part of Carl Sagan's history of listening to the universe. All right, I'm a physicist, so let me tell you a little bit about how physicists think. Physics tells the story of mathematical elements. Let me get away from that speaker. The surprising simplicity of the laws of nature and the beauty of the connected universe. This is how physicists really feel about these things. We like to ask why. And I want you to know, during today's presentation, please feel free to stop me and ask your questions. So, your first question might be, what is cosmology? It's the study of the history, structure, and dynamics of the known universe, and it also the predictions for the future of the known universe. Today, I'd like to tell you about the scale and the structure of space as we know it, the illusion of time, and it is an illusion. We're going to ask the question, is it possible to time travel? And then I'm going to tell you there's a special link between these two things, space and time. What is that link? And what is this thing that we've morphed together, space-time? And we'll talk about how our universe is changing, and I will leave you with a bunch of questions that will keep you from sleeping tonight. I know they do me. And I want to mention, since we're here, that often cosmology leads to discussions about religion and spirituality and the connection between them, and the kind of unique and wonderful connection between like theology and physics that we love to have these conversations. And I just want to name a few famous physicists and their religious practice. As you can see here, here's a few. These are very important theories, quantum theory, Einstein, relativity, space-time, general relativity, the beginnings of photovoltaics. A very mathematically skilled James Clerk Maxwell linked electricity and magnetism. Michael Faraday was an excellent experimentalist who laid the groundwork for this linkage. Watt, that is the same as the unit for power, Watt, James Watt, steam engine, classical mechanics, Isaac Newton, a good approximation for a lot of things, also the inventor of calculus. Galileo, the first telescope, and was the first person to actually observe that Jupiter had moons, and that was the first time somebody thought, things can orbit around another object besides Earth. Not everything orbits around us, or me. We are not the center of everything. There's at least moons out there that go around something else. And Kepler, of course, the laws of Kepler, planetary motion. This might be the only one you don't recognize. It's a sect of, have you heard of that? Has anyone heard of Sandemanian before? It's a Protestant sect from that era in London, and that's about as much as I gathered from that. Okay. I will ask you to participate if you want to. I will not force you to, but you can play my game by guessing with this low-tech multiple-choice clicker. Because physics education research shows that if you commit to an answer and want to know the answer because you want to know why you're right or wrong, then you'll remember it better. Let me tell you about our place in the universe. To get a sense of scale, we can't use meters, we can't use miles, we can't even use, like, radii of the Earth. We need something even bigger than that. To get a sense of scale, let's use light speed as a reference. So pretend you're standing somewhere where you're looking at a distant bright light, and you imagine to yourself, do I get that light as soon as it's turned on or slightly after? In 1 second, a traveler moving at the speed of light could go around the world how many times? What do you think? Just take a guess. And when you're ready, go ahead and hold up your card. You can fold it into whatever answer you choose and hold it up and show me. A traveler moving at the speed of light could go around the world how many times?
In 1 second.
In 1 second, yeah. All right, what do you think? Ooh, I see a scattering of answers. All right, so you might be surprised. The answer is C, 7.5 times. It is very fast, isn't it? So it would go around. Now, light only travels in a straight line, of course, but if a traveler could travel at that speed, it would go around the Earth 7.5 times in 1/1000. Yeah. Okay, with that in mind, how far away is the sun from Earth? In other words, if the sun were just to blow out and go dark, how soon would we know? What do you think? Feel free to take a guess. All right, I see another scattering of answers, but mostly around the correct one, which is 8 minutes. Light minutes is what we say. So light time is how we measure distance. Now, if I was the sun, 8 minutes. That means if our sun was like black, we wouldn't know it for 8 minutes. And we theorize that also gravity would take that long to let us know that we have been dropped from the sun's orbit, but that would be strange because the mass would have to go somewhere. And our sun is just a typical star with planets around it. Here's our planets. Let's see how modern this picture was. No Pluto. Yep, it's good.
Now, some of us are upset about that.
So,
yeah, now we're talking about reinstating it.
So if you're... if you've developed emotional displacement about that idea, here's my comment for you. This might help. Pluto's been dropped as one of the planets. However, now it is the prime example of protoplanets. It is the best protoplanet we know of. I don't know if that helps at all. Maybe you sleep a little bit better.
What's a protoplanet?
An asteroid, like a large, small but not too big planetary body. So one of the asteroids, like Ceres and Vesta, would be protoplanets. Okay, so beyond our solar system, This is supposed to represent those orbits, and there's one that has a tilted orbit. Is also this Oort cloud. I know, I love that word. Beyond the solar system, and this is an artist's view. The artist's name is Kagaya. An artist's rendition of these rocks beyond the solar system. Because the solar system contains only enough mass that every time a planet goes through like a ball of dust, it collects all of that dust, just like we do when a meteor falls on Earth. It means we're traveling by a bunch of dust and it's all getting collected. So you can imagine over, you know, millions and millions of years, you would sweep out an empty space here, but you would still leave some stuff that wasn't gravitationally attracted because it was too far away. So, another question for you. How long do you think it will take for light to cross the solar system? All the way across. For reference, Earth, and this is not to scale, but Earth was 8 minutes away from the sun. So if you went from one side of the solar system all the way to the other, how long would that take? All right, we're all over the map here, so 8 light hours to cross the solar system. That's how long, that's how big that is. It's a whole lot of empty space in there. Kind of like atoms. There's a whole lot of empty space in atoms. We're just filled with a lot of empty space. All right, let's step up another notch. Here's our solar system, right there. They say that the Milky Way looks a lot like some of the other spiral galaxies. The one difference between many of them that we've seen, this is an actual galaxy, it's not the Milky Way, but obviously we're in the Milky Way, so we can't get out of it to take a picture of it. So this is close, but they say that the Milky Way has about 10, I'm gonna call them tentacles, but they're spiral shapes that go outwards. So this has fewer than that. The Milky Way is a little bit, has more octopus arms. Okay, how far do you think it would take to cross the Milky Way from there all the way to there? Okay, I see mostly B. Awesome. 120,000 light years across. Yeah. 120,000 years. So when you look up at the stars, you are looking well into the past. Well into the past, because all the stars that we see are part of the Milky Way galaxy, containing hundreds of billions of stars. So let's get some perspective about this. When you look up at the Milky Way, has anyone ever seen the Milky Way?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, gorgeous, isn't it? Yeah, you can see it here if you wait late enough or are here in the wintertime. So I think I saw it around like midnight last night. You could kind of start seeing the Milky Way because it was bright. It's hard to see when the moon's out too. But when you look at that, here's for some like geometric perspective. You can kind of think of the Milky Way as like a frisbee or a plate that's spinning, and we're like where the peas would be on the dinner plate, you know? And when we look out from our planet or from our solar system at this side, it's very loud all of a sudden, at this clump of stars, what you're doing is you're looking along the plate at any point. And you can see, if you look, like, here's our plate, we're out here. If we look towards the center of the galaxy, we'll see, like, the constellation Sagittarius and some of the ones that are near the galactic center. So you can look out to see the accumulation of stars, but you'll still see stars up here because it also has some thickness, but it's mostly a spiral. When you look at light from a distant object, you're looking into the past, because it takes time for that light to get to you. And light is how we collect information about what's out there and what we see. The closest similar galaxy to ours is called Andromeda. It's 2.5 million light years away. This is an actual picture of it. And if you have some binoculars on a very, very dark sky, you can see it. It's actually quite close to the constellation Cassiopeia. You'd have to know kind of right where it is, but if you can look at a star map, and which you can download or find books on, you can find the location of this and you can see a blurry thing through your binoculars. And if you're saying to yourself, I wonder if that's it, that's it. Because it looks blurry, it doesn't quite look like, yeah. So that's why all the stars we look at in our night sky are part of our galaxy, because the closest galaxy looks like a little tiny blur. Here's our local group. So here's Andromeda, here's our galaxy, and this is a geometric representation of all of the other things, the local group of galaxies around us. So we are the two main ones in this local group, but it gets bigger. So there's that local group who is the Earth, the solar system, the galaxy, the local group of galaxies, and the local supercluster. Local supercluster, just one of them. These large structures are held together by gravity, spinning around each other due to the conservation of angular momentum. Sometimes spiraling inwards, sometimes spiraling outwards. Andromeda's actually on a collision course with ours, but it won't be in our lifetime. Don't worry, something else will get us first. On a large scale, this is fascinating. We've been able to take enough data about what we see out there to kind of get an idea for what the structure, the large scale structure of the universe really looks like. I think this is a tough question. Which one do you think it looks like? And this is just my interpretation of what I think it looks like. Do you think it looks like a branch in a tree or fern? Or is it like circles within circles? Evenly spaced clusters like cookies on a cookie sheet? Or is it like long straight lines of galaxies? What do you think? Yeah, this is a hard question. I don't expect anyone to know the answer to this. So let me just let you make your own decision. That's what it looks like. That's what we were able to interpret. And this is the cover of Nature magazine in September 2014. So this is relatively new data that we've collected. And this is called the, because it was discovered at the Keck Observatory in Hawaii, Laniakea supercluster, home of 100,000 galaxies, including our Milky Way. We're there, our local group is a little tiny speck of light right there. Isn't that fascinating? I think it kind of looks like a fern, but you can make up your own minds. There's also lines there too. But you can see how they're sort of gravitationally clustered.
So are you saying that all those light feathers, all the branches that you
see? Oh, that's good, feathers.
Those are light traces that have different ages. You know, one light trace is 100 million years old, one is 1,000 years old, one is 6 billion years old.
No, and that's a good question. And the answer is no. What this is each point of light here, which makes up this large picture, is a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies at some present moment.
Yes. But the way we know that is what we see now.
Right.
And of course, the farther out that it is, the longer ago that it was there.
Right. So this is so we extrapolate that. So we have to account for the time for each one when we kind of like normalize the data that we get by saying, well, that one's even further. So we look at its motion and project where it should have been, you know, 100 million years before that, where it would match with the picture. So it takes a lot of, that's why they made Nature magazine. Hard research. Yeah, so that's like as if you were to step back and take a very long exposure image.
Why is it different colors?
It's Nature magazine and the gussy it up. Good question. Maybe they're trying to represent red shifted and blue shifted, I don't know. In that case, it should be. And this is another artist's rendition. When I first saw this, I felt like it was like tree branches. Things that all kind of branch out from one another, these clusters, you know.
So my understanding was this is the cluster, how clusters look, and then if you back up one, that's a supercluster.
Yeah,
are different, actually.
Yeah, so there's, I know, it's like the local group.
Yeah.
A bunch of local groups make up a cluster,
and
a bunch of clusters make up a supercluster.
Supercluster, right.
And then there's more superclusters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
and my understanding was that 2014, they didn't even know superclusters existed.
We had a sense of it, but we didn't know what it looked like. We couldn't say what the structure was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. What I find fascinating about this is there's like empty space right here. Like total empty space right there. Okay? That's fascinating. Here's some images from the Hubble Space Telescope. One of the most wonderful instruments we have to look up at the sky and take long exposure images. And these, I would not go to the extent of saying they have been color enhanced. I would say they're using some kind of filter so that it's possible that some of these are, we evolved, how far back do I want to go? We live on Earth and our sun lets off light in the visible range. And so our eyes have adapted to see things that are in a very small range, the light that the sun produces, because that's all we're going to see, that's all we need. But some of these things have light in like the X-ray range, which we can't see unless we're Superman. So it would be a nice plot line for Superman to have lived on a star that had X-ray light coming off of it, but I don't think they did that. That was a, they missed an opportunity there. But if you put a filter on it, we can see with our visual eye what an X-ray image would look like. So this isn't really what we would see, but it's real.
So can you explain what those are, Katrina? Those gases?
Oh boy, most of these are nebulous. So I don't remember which ones they are, except that one I think is the Hourglass Nebula. So they're stars being formed or post-star explosions or collisions.
I think the lower left is the Horsehead Nebula.
Is it the Horsehead one?
Yeah.
It might be part of it. Yeah, the Horsehead one really looks like a horsehead. This might be the other side of it or something. I just feel like there's these wonderful pinnacles. Isn't it fascinating?
And it's a star nursery.
Yeah, it's basically like stars being formed. So a bunch of stars would be here. So this will be eventually accumulate because mass is attracted to other mass. Yeah, good. Some other beautiful things that we've seen in the sky. These are galaxies, this one and that one. This one is a big galaxy eating a small one.
Are these from the Hubble?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, isn't it amazing? Yeah, so we see, wow, we're not the only galaxy. This is a nebula, and I think that's a nebula also. Very different. This is my favorite, the Ring Nebula. Because you can really see it, like not with your naked eye, but with a decent telescope, you can see that it looks like a ring. Exploding star.
Yeah, can you explain what this nebula is?
I think it's an exploding star. Does anyone know if that, someone might have a correction to that?
I think that's right. I think it's a large starlight supernova.
It's collapsing? Yeah, I think you're right about that. Because some nebulas are stars forming and some are after. So I can't always remember which ones are which, because they all look different.
So, and then I believe the color is based on the speed of the gas moving away from the center. That's how they establish the color.
That might be true. Yeah, the shifting of those speeds. And speaking of shifting, okay, so we look out into the sky at the Milky Way, and we see that cluster of bright stars that goes across. But what do we see when we look at a place in the sky where there is literally nothing? People look out, there's a dark spot right there. I don't see any stars. Even with a good telescope, with a good lens, I look out there, I still don't see any stars. Well, there was some extra time on the Hubble Space Telescope. And people rent time on the telescope. And there was just a little bit of time when nobody had rented the telescope. And they thought, well, what the heck, let's do a long exposure at something that appears to be nothing. In other words, zoom in on a blank patch of sky. What do you think we'll see? And this is what they saw. Some people call this image the greatest image ever taken by humankind. Not that one, that one. When you open your camera lens for long enough, in a place where there looks like there's nothing, this is what you'll see. That's not, that's just the camera didn't finish taking the picture. This is called the Hubble Deep Field. Many physicists think this is the most important thing we've ever seen. These are many other galaxies that we have seen with evidence of with our own eyes, with our own instruments. We've looked out there and noticed, wow, we're not alone. Look at all that. Each speck is a galaxy. Each tinier speck is a galaxy further away. Okay, so we've talked about what's in space, but what is space? What if you took away all the stuff, all the galaxies, all the solar systems, all those branches that look like ferns and feather? What would be left in our universe if there was nothing, no thing, no object with mass? Nothing? Empty space is not nothing. This is something we're discovering. Empty space actually contains information. How do we make sense of something that looks like nothing? And if our universe, this is where you start losing sleep, what's beyond the nothing? Is there an edge to it? And what would be beyond
Is that when you get into string theory and gravity and stuff like that?
Yeah, general relativity and like geometry of space-time and our limited brains to be able to envision something that has more than three dimensions. this is a good example. If you're an ant and you live on the surface of a basketball, all you can do is crawl on the surface of the basketball. You can go this way, and strangely, you just walk in a straight line, eventually you end up where you started. That's odd, the ant thinks. I left this here, and now I've come back to it, and all I did was walk in a straight line. Or it can go this way, or it can look, you know, any way around this universe where it lives on this line. But if I am a person holding the basketball, I clearly say, ant, you do not know the space that you live in. You live in a three-dimensional object, because I am a person who can view three-dimensional objects. Now, imagine somebody standing outside the basketball and says, humans, you live in a three-dimensional universe, but I have this four-dimensional thing or 11-dimensional thing that you just don't know about because all you're constrained by your three-dimensionality, the way that the ant is constrained by its two-dimensionality. It can walk forward or back or side to side, and that's it. We can walk forward, back, side to side, or up or down, and that's it. That's all we know about. So in the 1600s, Newton, who invented calculus, said space is a stage or a framework. It's stuck like that. Einstein said it's more than that. It's not just stuck like that, nor is time. It all comes down to one key idea, and that's the idea of light. So let's go back to this for a moment. Before we can even get to what light is, we have to first define time, which turned out to be quite a difficult thing to define. I'm going to ask you to do it. Can you define what time is without using words that contain time, like while, or moment, or minute, or second, or past, or present, or temporal? How do we even define time? It's hard to do it because we live in this time, right? Like, I know everybody's brain just went, the gears were like, they're all stuck like that. Me too. So physicists define it like this. Time is the fourth dimension. An event can be described fully by three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. It's just a variable in our equation. And it is variable. It's not constant. Yeah.
Time is what keeps things from happening all at once. Which is really good because our brains would not be able to comprehend that.
That's an interesting thought.
We can't.
That it exists like that because otherwise we wouldn't be able to comprehend it.
Right.
Oh, I like
that. That's the blessing that God has given us.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's great. I'm going to recommend Brian Greene's Fabric of the Cosmos to get this, like, slices of time, because as you look further away, things are farther away. And something that might appear to happen at the same time in two different places to another observer might not appear to happen at those same places in time. Ooh, slices of time.
Yeah, or maybe a different way to put it is that one person's concept of once, which I think you just used in the definition, is not the same as another person's definition of once.
At the same,
the same moment.
It's really interesting.
They can't agree on what the same moment.
Yeah, which gets into like twin paradoxes and that sort of thing, relativity, the kind of things that we draw in those situations.
So I can define what time is, but it only works for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's this concept called simultaneity, which is different depending on the observer and how fast they're going and where they are. Yeah. It's all relative. Okay, so time awareness. We've been aware of time for a long time, and we've defined different ways of measuring it. Back then, we had ways of measuring it that, like, okay, once a year the sun shines through this bright spot, we call that once a year, say the summer solstice. We were able to divide the day up, so we divided the year, then we divided the day, then we divided the minute, and now we can divide the second to very, very accurate. This is in some basement in Colorado, actually NIST. If it's coming from NIST, it's Washington, D.C. I think there's one in both. Dividing the second into very accurate times. Okay, now we have enough information to talk about light. Consider this. I'm going to make your brains do the gear thing again. A parked car's headlights. So the car's just sitting there, and the light is shining towards you. Okay? The car shines its light at you, and if you're one of those deer, you're just standing there, Or keep eating, like when the bus came up when I was walking. Was anyone on that bus last Saturday? The deer was standing in the road, it looked at us, and it was like, just keep eating. Like, come on. With what speed does the light travel away from this car towards you? I'm standing here watching this car shine lights at me. I don't, maybe the deer is thinking about this. The light is traveling at the speed of light, thinks the deer. That makes sense. It's a nice constant speed. It's parked. Everything's good. Light speed, 671 million miles. And sorry that I cut that off, an hour. Okay, now, what if the car is driving towards you? It's moving towards you. You're still that very courageous deer that doesn't want to move. With what speed does the light travel away from this car towards you? Two options. Is it light speed plus the car speed, or is it light speed? At what speed would you be receiving that light? What if the car is driving really, really fast? A or B? Oh, turns out I cannot trick you. Okay, what is that? The answer is light speed. No matter how fast that car is driving, it can drive very close to the speed of light, and you would still only receive that light. I know, right? Look, the same speed as before. It doesn't matter how fast the car is moving. You would still be receiving light. You know, if you had a solar panel, you'd still be gathering the same information at the same amount of time that it was before. Okay, how can this happen? Einstein looked at this and really thought about this and came up with a very radical idea that was not believed for decades, really. Light doesn't act like regular objects. You know, if you're driving a car and you throw a ball outside the car, let's say you put your hand out and you throw it that way. If someone's over there, they would measure the speed of the ball as the speed that you threw it plus the speed that the car was driving at. For light, if I held my hand out with a flashlight, that doesn't happen. Light doesn't act the same as other objects. It's the one thing that acts very, very differently. The ball would have the speed added to the car speed, but Einstein's radical idea was that space itself is being warped to accommodate this very strange concept that accommodate constant light speed to any observer at any time, anywhere. And time is also being warped to make it so that any observer anywhere in the universe would measure light coming at them at the same speed. Yeah. So time itself can't even be constant. And this is how that happens. This is just a special relativity. Version of explaining that. So space is flexible, time is flexible. Light speed is not. Light speed is constant. So here we go. From outside, the car would appear to be squished. You would hear the clock. So if you're standing watching a car move really, really fast, you would be listening very carefully, and you would hear the car ticking, the clock in the car ticking slower than what you would expect. So to an outside observer, fast-moving objects contain slower time. Like, I would be looking at my clock going, that guy's clock is off. It's going super slow. And the faster they go, the slower it would go. And you would hear the clock in the car ticking slower than normal. Time can run at different rates depending on motion. Now, if you were driving that car, the time would be totally normal. To you, it would be 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 1,000, but someone watching you go by would go, ah, God's clock is really messed up. So it depends which observer you are. And I would be standing outside saying, that's one of those smart cars. And the guy driving it, or the gal driving it, might say, nope, the regular car. See, and see you later. Actually, it would sound like, see you later. Right? Inside. All would seem normal. Space and time change. They accommodate so that light can always travel at light speed measured by any observer moving at any speed relative to that first thing anywhere in the universe. That is the radical idea that Einstein came up with. And when I tell this to my students, they're like, no, what? Which is exactly what the physics community did when Einstein came out with that. In fact, you'll notice that he got a Nobel Prize, but it was not for this, because it took decades for people to truly believe that this was happening. The scientists, by the time the Nobel Prize was given, it was for like the photoelectric effect. Much less cool than this, but still cool. The physics community wanted to give him a Nobel Prize because they knew he did something special, but the world would not accept a Nobel Prize for something so weird. So they're like, oh, he also did this other thing, the photoelectric effect. What a great thing, we'll give you a Nobel Prize for that. When everyone in the community of science was like, secretly it's for the relativity. But we just thought he needed recognition. Space and time are entangled into a single continuum. Because they contain information about how fast things are moving, and light speed has to be the same all the time. There are different manifestations of the same thing, and we call space and time this linkage space-time. Light speed must remain constant. So, now our question is, what is space-time? The fabric of the universe. Space-time is what we consider the fabric of the universe. It's warped and stretched by massive objects. So here's the other thing that's weird about, you know, like you can have constant light speed for any observer anywhere, but also this fabric has to be bent by massive objects. It changes to allow the speed of light to remain constant. The other thing is the fabric itself is expanding. It's kind of like raisin bread. You might consider like everything in the bread, the raisins, as moving apart when you bake the bread, but they're not moving apart. The space that they are living in is actually expanding as you bake the bread. So it's not the raisins themselves moving away from each other, it's the bread itself that's moving them apart because it's expanding. And it had a beginning, which we can trace back. And I'll talk about that later. Okay, so we have these two, you know, towering figures in physics. Isaac Newton in the 1600s, and Albert Einstein in the early 1900s. These ideas are not as dissimilar as we might think. Newton said, space and time are separate. Time is a steady-paced thing, it does not change. Space is a fixed, unchanging stage. That's the word that he used. It's like a stage where everything exists. But the question is, then, why does gravity hold things in orbit across empty space? How can empty space transmit information about one object to another? If there's literally nothing in it, how can you get information from one thing to another? Einstein said, not a contradiction, an expansion of the idea. Gravity is the result of stretchy, invisible space-time warped by massive objects. And we draw this as a two-dimensional surface because I don't have a way of drawing it as a three-dimensional surface without, you know, obstructing all the views of the things that contain mass. So you can think of like the moon going around Earth, kind of like when you put a penny in one of those things that's like at the zoo sometimes. That's like what the moon does on a bent space-time. So it's the fabric of the space-time that makes the moon do that. That's how you transmit the information from one thing to another.
Katie?
Yeah.
And you mentioned massive objects down there. I guess what you really mean is any object with mass.
Yes, not right, not massive
any,
like big.
Right.
Massive like mass.
Yeah.
Like I'm a massive object. This is a massive object.
Yes.
Yes. A photon is not a massive object because it has
so
no
we
mass.
Actually, what that means is that each one of us warps space time.
Yes.
And,
just a little. Yep.
And because there is actually space between particles and between atoms, between molecules, and space-time doesn't just exist outside of objects.
Right.
It's all
yes.
through everything.
Everywhere. Everywhere, yeah. And so one of the problems that I like to solve for with my students is two people who stand half a meter apart are attracted to one another, and then they pull various pickup lines from that that they decide to use. It never quite worked for them. So you can calculate the force of attraction between any two objects. Me and this thing, I'm attracted to all of you in this room right now. And you're attracted to me. Yeah, so it's everywhere. It's like the fabric everywhere. What's interesting about that comment that you just made, is that inside the atom, those things that have mass are attracted to one another. But the gravity, the electrostatic and the strong force are so much more dominant than the gravitational force that as a good approximation, you can eliminate, you know, the gravity force on atoms, for example. Yeah, isn't that neat? It's everywhere. So, it's important for me to note here, I'm not poking fun at Isaac Newton. He was not wrong. His theories were good approximations, but do not work when there are fast speeds and massive objects. So something going close to the speed of light and something that is enormously huge that they noticeably warp space-time, that's when you need more than what Isaac Newton was able to give us. And he did pretty well for a person who could only hold and throw apples, you know, and not look out at expanding galaxies, space-time sort of thing. He had to wait for Galileo to come along with his telescope. So Isaac Newton in the 1900s discovered more accurate equations for these cases of close to light speed and really, really massive objects. Okay. Time travel. Let's hit that. So let's just speculate if time is not constant. So I've just told you that time doesn't travel at a constant, it's not like just a tick, 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 tick for everybody in the universe. Do you think time travel is possible? And just consider to yourself, if so, how, with the information that we have? And if not, how could you rule it out? So let's consider two cases. Time travel to the future. You could kind of do it like this. You could travel to a very massive object. You could buy your ticket here on Earth to a rocket that was going to go and orbit a black hole. Gets really, really close to a massive object. Maybe orbits around it for a little while. Maybe you've seen Interstellar. Relatively solid physics in that, except, well, no spoilers. And by doing that, you make your clock run slower, like we talked about. Your car looks tiny, and the people who maybe watch your spaceship go away to the black hole, they go, wow, something's wrong with their clock. It's getting really slow as they come over that black hole, or near that black hole, and not go in it. And you return to Earth younger than the others that you left behind, because your clock literally ran slower compared to theirs. That's the twin paradox, part of it. Does it seem practical? Not really. Possible? Yes. Time travel in the future, you heard it here, folks. Possible. Time travel to the past. Let's consider this. If time travel to the past is possible, and we just haven't discovered how, then why haven't we seen time travelers in our time, particularly in January this year in Washington, D.C.? Why didn't Doc show up right before our inauguration, right? I'm sorry. That's a joke that you're on the... Where was Marty McFly at that moment? I'm sorry. So, I think we can rule that out. Okay, I'm teasing. Practical. Seems unlikely. Possible? Well, here's the thing about physics. You can't really rule out time travel to the past. And that's the caveat to this. Because the laws of physics are just equations, are just mathematical equations. They don't show a preference for time running forward or backwards. You can put a negative sign in front of that T and still have all the equations be valid. Yeah. There seems to be no preference for forward or backward traveling time. We also determined, via observation, astronomers contributed to this one, particularly Edwin Hubble, that space-time is expanding. And this is how we did it, with spectral analysis. I've got one of these. I actually brought quite a few, because I wondered how many people would show up. But everybody go ahead and take one of those. Pass that around. And I don't recommend, do not look at the sun through this, but look at other bright lights or objects through these spectral glasses. I recommend bending both of the folds that they have on either side. Now, the chemistry professor could explain this better than me, but I'm going to give it a shot. Every object, every element, if you burned it in gas form, perhaps, you would see, if you were able to break up the spectrum of light, for example, take a prism up to that light, you would have the light from that object being burned, that chemical being burned, element, and it would project into different colors. And it would create a very specific spectrum of light. Spectrum meaning you would see like red, teal, and yellow. And those would be the colors that you get from that particular element. Now, if you were really practiced at looking at spectrums of various elements being burned, you would say, oh, I recognize that spectrum as mercury. I recognize that spectrum as hydrogen. Or you would recognize a spectrum coming from substance that was a combination of mercury and hydrogen, because it would be an overlap of the two spectral lines together. In other words, different wavelengths of color that you get out from that. So as you look around the room with your diffraction glasses, you're looking through a diffraction screen, it's like a little tiny window screen. You're breaking light up into its spectrum. Not everything let's see if there's fluorescent lights around here somewhere. Not everything gives a complete rainbow. Some of them have gaps, so you can see how the light that you're seeing is made up of certain elements. And as an astronomer, you get very practiced at noticing which elements were being, which spectral lines we're getting. The moral of the story is you could look out at a star and do an experiment on it. You would say, that star is made up of hydrogen and helium or something. You know what things are made of just by looking at them burn. That's how we do experiments millions of years away. So, the other thing is, as light travels towards you or away from you, you can shift the wavelength of that light. So, if a wavelength of light looks like this, which it doesn't, it's actually much smaller than this, and you were sitting right over here, you would actually see that light wave look a little bit more condensed if it's moving this way. And if I'm moving this way, it would look a little bit elongated. Just like when you hear a train go by, or a car, and it goes, you've heard that sound? This is the sound, a wave of sound coming towards you, compressed, and that's the sound of a wave of sound being elongated. So it's lower as it goes away, and it's higher as it comes towards you. And you hear that, light does the same thing. So you can extrapolate how these galaxies that you look at are red-shifted or blue-shifted, which means, are they moving away from you, or are they coming towards you? So you can look, you get really practiced, and you say, that looks like a helium spectrum, except all of the yellow line that's supposed to be there looks a little bit more orange, meaning that galaxy is moving away from you. With that information, you can keep those glasses. We can trace back Hubble's expansion data to estimate the age of the universe, which is called the Hubble time. In the standard cosmological model, it is roughly 14 billion years, or 13.8 billion years. It's always being adjusted slightly.
Is that assuming that it's expanding at a constant rate?
Good question. Expanding at a constant rate. Yeah, so accelerating at a constant rate, which means...
Accelerating.
Yeah, so there's a rate of change of a rate of change there, okay. So yeah.
Katie?
Yeah.
I remember there was a twist to this story too, and I can't remember the guy's name, but it kind of ties back to your, you know, what religions were these different people. There was a Roman Catholic priest who looked at Hubble's observations and put together a theory. And the observations were that Hubble made was that everything was redshifted. Everything, which meant one of two things. Either we are at the center of the universe, and maybe you're going to.
I thought I had data for that. I guess I don't.
Yeah. Either we are at the center of the universe, which is possible but not likely, or the universe is expanding. And if the universe is expanding, then we could go back in time. We could put a negative T in front of that, solve the equations, and you get back to the beginning.
Yeah, which is right. Basically what they did with that data. You plot it out on a line, and then you draw it backwards to see where...
But what I can't remember was the guy's name, but he was a Roman Catholic priest who came up with the Big Bang Theory.
Does anyone remember? I don't actually know.
It starts with an L, and I can't remember his name. But it's an astonishing story.
The interesting thing about us appearing to be the center of the universe... Okay, let's get back to the raisin bread. This is such a good comment because this takes a little like Gedanken experiment to figure this out. So, which is a thought experiment. If you imagine you are one of the raisins in the raisin bread.
Lemaitre. I didn't want to forget.
Oh, Lemaitre. Yeah.
Georges Lemaitre.
Lemaitre. Good. Good. Yeah. Way to pull that out. So, if you imagine you are one of the raisins in the raisin bread while you are in the oven and the bread is baking. If you're one of the raisins and you look at your raisin friends and you say, weren't you closer to me? All of these raisins reasons. They're moving away from me. What is wrong with me? Everybody hates me. I smell bad. I'm this raisin that nobody wants to be around. And all the other raisins are saying the same thing, because all of the bread is expanding. That every galaxy appears to be the center of the universe. And everybody could interpret the data like that. I'm the center of the universe. Everyone is moving away from me. And you can basically overlap two images to see how it looks as if you put your image of one thing bigger than the other, it appears that, so, okay, let me take this. Look, if I take this image right here and I blow it up just slightly, and then I overlap the two images such that the A's line up at the very center, it would appear that this B is further and that C is, D is further and C is further. However, if I then put it on B, it would appear that A is further and C is further and D is further. No matter where you put it, where you line it up, it looks like everything is expanding from everything else. Yeah, that's neat. It's like our Copernican attitude that makes us think, well, everything orbits around us. And I'm going to touch on that again in an even bigger question for you.
When Einstein heard Lemaître's theory, at first he said, no, that's baloney.
Oh, you're talking about the cosmological constant. Yes, oh gosh.
And then he said, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard.
The biggest blunder of his
career. Well, that's a different comment.
Oh, okay, that's not that one.
But, you know, when he first considered Lemaître's theory, he rejected it, and then he realized that, wait a minute, that's the only acceptable solution. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
Yeah. So when Hubble came after Einstein, and it was about the same time, was living around the same time, but 1905 was when that relativity and the general relativity was discovered by Einstein. And then later, Edwin Hubble made these he made these observations that told us that everything else in the universe was moving away from us, except Andromeda is blue shifted because we're going to collide. which was odd at that time. So Einstein was able to see Edwin Hubble's experiment observations. And before that, Einstein had written this general relativity formula, which is rather complex in notation. And it contained a factor which came out of the equations. He didn't put it in. It was this factor that appeared that you could change the dynamics of space. He just assumed, no, that can't be. So he added another factor to cancel that one out. His original equation predicted expansion or contraction of the universe. It predicted a dynamic universe, and he was like, that can't possibly be. So he put back another factor to cancel that out, and he said that was the biggest blunder of his career, adding that other thing instead of looking at the physics the ways that nature was giving him. It was giving him the answer that he could have predicted this, and he thought, oh, Hubble, okay, that's the real thing. And so he took that out. But now we keep it in there's a far bigger story there. So I'll stop there, otherwise we'll get into general relativity, which we don't even teach the undergrads. A sad consequence, this is very interesting. We will appear to be alone in the universe much later down in history, unless we look into our history books and remember what we know and can see now. So if we wait a very, very long time, those galaxies that we see, the thing is, light does not travel as fast as the universe is expanding. So as things get farther away from us, eventually, we haven't even been around long enough to collect that light from the galaxies that are traveling away from us. So one day, well in the future, or perhaps another civilization on another planet warp somewhere, those entities would say, nope, we're alone in the universe, can't see a darn thing. We're it. We're the center. We're the only thing out here. So we'll have to keep those books. How fortunate that we live in this time, in our universe, when we can see into the past just by looking skyward. Space and time are not what they appear to be. Space and time are linked. They are warpable. They are flexible. The result of this is transmission of the information of gravity or mass, massive objects, objects with mass. Why? Because light speed is the only thing that can be constant in the universe. That's something that Einstein put together. And I want to leave you laying awake in your beds tonight, not able to sleep, with these comments. Almost all of the space in the universe is empty space. just like almost all the space inside of an atom is empty space. Why, how is space-time expanding? We know that it is. Is, was, will there be life elsewhere in the universe? Is time travel possible? Is the universe truly infinite, or could we find an edge? What would be beyond the edge? And I love this one the most. And let me give you a little history here on this question. There was a time when we thought the civilization that we live in is the only one. There is nobody else. And then we found there were other civilizations. We could cross the ocean, and there's a whole other civilization of people living over there. And then we assumed that everything that we see in the night sky is revolving around us, because we are the center of the we are the center of the known whatever, and everything is revolving around us. And then we looked out and saw other stars and realized those stars are like suns. They're like our sun. Oh my, there's more suns out there. And then we thought, well, okay, we're in the galaxy. Ours is the only galaxy filled with stars, right? And then we saw more galaxies. Well, now there's more galaxies. We're not the only galaxy. We're not unique. And then there's clusters and superclusters. What if we expand that idea to universes? Why are we so proud that ours is the only universe? So it's like the Copernican expansion of that idea. What makes us so special? We have to keep evaluating that question. I wanted to tell you about something totally unrelated. I wrote a book for kids because I want to reach out to kids with a positive message about science. I've got some bookmarks if you want them, and also there's a book in the library of one of my books that you can check out and rent. Thank you.